This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Two individuals and the Council of Canadians with Disabilities filed a legal action in the British Columbia Supreme Court on September 13, 2016, to challenge a BC law that forces psychiatric treatment on people without their consent. The case alleges that the law violates the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I spoke with Laura Johnston, one of the lawyers with Community Legal Assistance Society, representing the plaintiffs. Give us a sense of the BC Mental Health Act's provisions for what's described as deemed consent. How does that work?
In Canadian law, it's a very fundamental right to be able to make our own healthcare decisions. So we rely on doctors to provide their medical advice to us about which options they think we should take. But ultimately, it's up to us as individuals to consent or refuse consent to proposed medical treatment based on our values and beliefs. In BC, however, if you have an involuntary status under the Mental Health Act, whether you're in hospital or living in community, everyone is deprived of the right to make their own psychiatric treatment decisions. So the law says that everyone is legally deemed to have consented already to all forms of psychiatric treatment. That means in practice that doctors can forcibly medicate people and forcibly administer electroconvulsive therapy. It also means that a legal representative or a family member is not allowed to make decisions for the person with involuntary status. The doctor gets to act unilaterally. So the case that we've brought argues that these laws are a charter violation.
British Columbia is the only jurisdiction in Canada, apparently, that still uses a deemed consent model. What's happening elsewhere in the country?
Every province and territory takes a bit of a different approach to treatment consent rights for involuntary patients. For example, in Nova Scotia, you can't be an involuntary patient unless you are found to be incapable of making your own treatment decisions already, and then they go to a substitute decision maker for you. In Ontario, for example, there's an assessment about whether or not you're capable of making your treatment decisions or not, and a whole scheme around that. BC is the only model in Canada that uses a deemed consent model, where the law presumes everyone is mentally incapable and doesn't provide an assessment and doesn't provide any recourse to another decision maker. So you don't have to go to court, you don't have to go to a tribunal, you don't have to go to a substitute decision maker. The individual doctor gets to both propose and then forcibly administer treatment without any other check or balance.
You're one of the Community Legal Assistance Society lawyers for the plaintiffs in a case filed in the BC Supreme Court that challenges this BC law that is seen as forcing psychiatric treatment on people without their consent. What can you tell us about the case?
The case challenges the deemed consent provisions in the Mental Health Act and some of the overrides on healthcare consent rights in the Healthcare Consent and Care Facility Admission Act and the Representation Agreement Act. And our argument in the case is that these laws are a violation of our Section 7 right to life, liberty, and security of the person under the Charter, because forced treatment involves, you know, non-consensual touching, quite a high level of physical force, and deprivation of your ability to decide what goes in your body at a very fundamental level. The case also argues that these laws are a Section 15 violation of our right to equality because they deprive people with mental disabilities or perceived mental disabilities of the same rights and protections at law that everyone else is entitled to.
What can you tell us about the plaintiffs in this case?
There are three plaintiffs in this case. Two individuals who have been subjected to forced psychiatric treatment, and a public interest litigant, the Council of Canadians with Disabilities. So the two individuals, one is a 66-year-old retired nurse named Louise McLaren. She herself has had experience working in psychiatric wards as a nurse with involuntary patients. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in the mid-80s and has been coping with that for, you know, many decades since then. And she's found a treatment regime that works for her. She has been subjected to over 300 rounds of electroconvulsive therapy in her life and also forced psychiatric medications, including injections pills. So she would like to be able to make her own treatment decisions and, in particular, have fewer rounds of electroconvulsive therapy. Sometimes it's been forced on her up to 3 times a week, which is very frequent. The other individual plaintiff, who can only be known in the case as DC, is a 24-year-old man who recently graduated from Harvard University. He's had a variety of queries and diagnoses. No one's been able to land on a useful diagnosis for him. People have labeled him with everything from Asperger's disorder to ADD to schizophreniform disorder to bipolar disorder. And he has been forcibly injected with antipsychotic medications. So those are our two individual plaintiffs. The Council of Canadians with Disabilities is a nonprofit national human rights organization that's participating in the case as a way to bring a perspective from the lived experiences of other people with disabilities.
Two individuals and the Council of Canadians with Disabilities filed a legal action in the British Columbia Supreme Court on September 13, 2016, to challenge a BC law that forces psychiatric treatment on people without their consent. The case alleges that the law violates the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. People who are involuntarily detained under BC's Mental Health Act or released from hospital on leave currently have no right to give or refuse consent to any psychiatric treatment. They are legally deemed to consent to all psychiatric treatment and can be forcibly administered medications and electroconvulsive therapy even when they are mentally capable of making their own treatment decisions. The law also deprives detained individuals of the right to a substitute decision maker, like a representative or family member, to give or refuse consent on their behalf. Laura Johnston is one of the lawyers with Community Legal Assistance Society, representing the plaintiffs in the case brought to the British Columbia Supreme Court. Here's the rest of my conversation with Laura Johnston. Laura, you told the Straight that the case will not affect emergency mental health care. Tell us about that distinction.
In law, there are emergency provisions. For example, I've said as a general statement that everyone gets to make their own health care decisions and doctors need consent. But if, for example, I walk out on the street today and I'm hit by a bus and I'm taken to the emergency department and I'm unconscious, you know, obviously I'm incapable in that moment of making my own treatment decisions because I'm not conscious. But the doctor, if I'm, you know, bleeding profusely, can act in that emergency to provide me with treatment without getting substitute consent for me, so they can stop the bleeding and stabilize me. Similarly, if someone were to present in an ER or be apprehended by the police and brought to a hospital because they were in an extreme state of mental unhealth and, you know, they were perhaps a risk of harm to themselves or the staff or other patients, then a doctor can act under those emergency provisions to force treatment in that moment to stabilize the patient. This case is not challenging that emergency provision. So, you know, some of the questions that often come up when you describe this case is, well, what would happen? Does this mean a doctor can't treat in an emergency? And that is not at all what the case is arguing. So the emergency provisions are not being challenged. They'll remain intact, even if we succeed in the case. The question in the case is simply, okay, so it's not an emergency anymore. The patient is stable. Now what? Can you unilaterally continue to impose treatment? Or at that point in time, do you need to involve, you know, an assessment to see whether or not that patient can make their own decisions? Or if they can't, a substitute decision maker on their behalf.
You're quoted in the news release about this charter challenge as saying the following, quote, many people delay seeking or don't seek mental health care because they fear being involuntarily detained under the Mental Health Act and losing all control of their treatment. Tell us more about that, Laura, and what you're aware of in terms of that dynamic.
The Community Legal Assistance Society provides legal services to hundreds of people who are either involuntarily detained at the time or have been involuntarily detained. And many people tell us that, you know, when they start seeing mental health symptoms in themselves, that they're really frightened about seeking out any healthcare treatment for that because they know that any contact with the healthcare system could result in involuntary detention and a removal of their ability to make any treatment decisions on their behalf. So essentially, forced treatment is operating in a way that prevents people getting access to treatment. You know, forced treatment, the case is going to argue, also brings about its own order of harms, not only this chilling effect in preventing people from seeking help, but also the trauma inflicted with forced treatment. You know, I think when you hear forced medication, you think that someone's handing someone else medication to swallow in a pill form, and that does happen. But it also happens that individuals are put in four-point physical restraints and tied down to a bed. People can be restrained and held down by security staff or ward staff, have their clothing removed from them. Female patients have no right to have female care providers or female security staff do that. And, you know, there's injections of needles and all kinds of forms of coercion and physical restraint here. So it can actually be quite a traumatic experience to be subjected to forced treatment and have many counter-therapeutic effects. So there's a growing body of research that indicates that forced treatment may actually be resulting in lower treatment compliance with treatment plans and its own order of harm or damage to therapeutic relationships with healthcare providers.
What happens next in this case?
The case has just been filed in BC Supreme Court. So the next thing that will happen is the government needs to decide how to respond. So at any point in time, the BC government could stand up and say, you're right, this law does not comply with the charter, and we are going to fix this situation. So there was a case in 1991 in Ontario that challenged the constitutionality of some mechanisms that could force treatment in that province. And the Ontario Court of Appeal found that unconstitutional as early as 1991. And most of the other provinces and territories have stepped up to clean up their laws to make sure that they comply with the charter. Unfortunately, BC has sat back and let this unconstitutional law sit on the books for another 25 years. You know, absolutely the BC government could step up and remedy that at any time, and then we wouldn't have to go to trial. If the BC government chooses to descend the laws and take us to trial, unfortunately that will have to be our next steps. And because of delays in the system and how slow legal proceedings are, it could be several months before we could get to trial.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
You know, what really strikes me about this law is that it assumes that everyone with a mental health problem is mentally incompetent of making their own decisions. And that kind of assumption is completely inaccurate. And of course, based on historical stereotypes or prejudice against people with mental health problems that really have no basis in our current world and really have no basis in our current laws. So I do hope that, you know, we can have a conversation about making our laws really reflect reality and the lived experiences of people with mental health problems and their own, you know, fight to have a say in their own treatment and their own recovery.
Laura Johnston, thank you very much for speaking with me about this.
Well, thank you for having me and for your interest in this case.
Laura Johnston is a lawyer with the Vancouver-based Community Legal Assistance Society. Laura is one of the lawyers representing plaintiffs in legal action filed with the British Columbia Supreme Court to challenge a BC law that forces psychiatric treatment on people without their consent. The case alleges that the law violates the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. You can find out more online at CLASBC.net. That's CLASBC.net.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpages.